People sitting 30 rows up swore they heard Rabbit's bones break. If Lightning had continued his sprint, the controversy would have been lessened considerably. But the poor kid was so shocked that he glanced over his shoulder to see who and what he had just run over, and in doing so lost his balance. It took 15 yards for him to complete his fall, and when he came to rest somewhere around the 20-yard line, the field was covered with yellow flags. While the trainers huddled over Rabbit and debated whether to call for an ambulance or a minister, the officials quickly awarded the touchdown to Greene County, a decision that Rake argued with for a moment then conceded. Rake was as shocked as anyone, and he was also concerned about Rabbit, who hadn't moved a muscle since hitting the ground. It took 20 minutes to gather Rabbit up and place him gently on the stretcher and shove him into an ambulance. As it drove away, 10,000 Messina fans stood and applauded with respect. The folks from Greene County, uncertain as to whether they too should applaud or boo, just sat quietly and tried to digest what they had seen. They had their touchdown, but the poor idiot appeared to be dead. Rake, always the master motivator, used the delay to incite his troops. "Rabbit's hitting harder than you clowns," he growled at his defense. "Let's kick some ass and take the game ball to Rabbit." Messina scored 3 touchdowns in the fourth quarter and won easily. Rabbit survived too. His collarbone was broken and 3 lower vertebrae were cracked. His concussion was not severe, and those who knew him well claimed they noticed no additional brain damage. Needless to say, Rabbit became a local hero. At the annual football banquet thereafter, Rake awarded a Rabbit trophy for the hit of the year. The lights grew brighter as dusk came to an end, their eyes refocused in the semi-lit darkness of Rake Field. Another, smaller group of old Spartans had materialized at the far end of the bleachers. Their voices were barely audible. Silo opened another bottle and drained half of it. "When was the last time you saw Rake?" Blanchard Teague asked Neely. "A couple days after my first surgery," Neely said, and everyone was still. He was telling a story that had never been told before in Messina. "I was in the hospital," he said. "One surgery down, 3 to go." "It was a cheap shot," Couch mumbled, as if Neely needed to be reassured. "Damn sure was," said Amos Kelso. Neely could see them, huddling in the coffee shops on Main Street, long, sad faces, low, grave voices, as they replayed the late hit that instantly ruined the career of their All-American. A nurse told him she had never seen such an outpouring of compassion. Cards, flowers, chocolates, balloons, artwork from entire classes of grade schoolers. All from the small town of Messina, 3 hours away. Other than his parents and the Tech coaches, Neely refused all visitors. For 8 long days, he drowned himself in pity, aided mightily by as many painkillers as the doctors would allow. Rake slipped in one night, long after visiting hours were over. "He tried to cheer me up," Neely said, sipping a beer. "Said knees could be rehabbed. I tried to believe him." "Did he mention the 87 championship game?" Silo asked. "We talked about it." There was a long, awkward pause as they contemplated that game and all the mysteries around it. It was Messina's last title, and that alone was a source rich enough for years of analysis. Down 31-0 at halftime, roughed up and manhandled by a vastly superior team from East Pike, the Spartans returned to the field at A&M, where 35,000 fans were waiting. Rake was absent. He didn't appear until late in the fourth quarter. The truth about what happened had remained buried for 15 years, and, evidently, neither Silo, Neely, nor Paul, nor Hubcap Taylor were about to break the silence. In the hospital room, Rake had finally apologized, but Neely had told no one. Teague and Couch said goodbye and jogged away in the darkness. "You never came back, did you?" Yeager asked. "Not after I got hurt," Neely said. "Why not?" "I didn't want to." Hubcap had been working quietly on a pint of something much stronger than beer. He'd said little, and when he spoke, his tongue was thick. "People say you hated Rake." "That's not true. And he hated you." "Rake had a problem with the stars," Paul said. "We all knew that. If you won too many awards, set too many records, Ray got jealous, plain and simple. He worked us like dogs, and he wanted every one of us to be great. But when guys like Neely got all the attention, then Ray got envious. I don't believe that, Orly Short grunted. It's true. Plus, he wanted to deliver the prizes to whatever college he happened to like at the moment. He wanted Neely at State. He wanted me in the Army, Silo said. Lucky you didn't go to prison, Paul said. It ain't over yet, Silo said with a laugh. Another car rolled to a stop by the gate, and its headlights went off. No door opened. Prison's underrated, Hubcap said, and everyone laughed. Rake had his favorites, Neely said. I wasn't one of them. Then why are you here? Asked Orly Short. I'm not sure. Same reason you're here, I guess. During Neely's freshman year at Tech, he had returned from Messina's homecoming game. In a halftime ceremony, they retired number 19. The standing ovation went on and eventually delayed the second half kickoff, which cost the Spartans 5 yards and prompted Coach Rake, leading 28-0, to start yelling. That was the only game Neely had watched since he left. 1 year later, he was in the hospital. When did they put up Rake's bronze statue? He asked. A couple of years after they fired him, Yeager said. The boosters raised $10,000 and had it done. They wanted to present it to him before a game, but he refused. So he never came back. Well, sort of. Yeager pointed to a hill in the distance behind the clubhouse. He'd drive up on Carr's Hill before every game and park on one of those gravel roads. He and Miss Lila would sit there, looking down, listening to Buck Caulfield on the radio, too far away to see much, but making sure the town knew he was still watching. At the end of every halftime, the band would face the hill and play the fight song, and all 10,000 would wave at Rake. It was pretty cool, said Amos Kelso. Rake knew everything that was going on, Paul said. Rabbit called him twice a day with the gossip. Was he a recluse? Neely asked. He kept himself, Amos said, for the first 3 or 4 years anyway. There were rumors that he was moving, but then rumors don't mean much here. He went to Mass every morning, but that's a small crowd in Messina. He got out more in the last few years, Paul said, started playing golf. Was he bitter? The question was pondered by the rest of them. Yeah, he was bitter, Yeager said. I don't think so, Paul said. He blamed himself. Rumor has it that they'll bury him next to Scotty, Amos said. I heard that too, Silo said, very deep in thought. A car door slammed and a figure stepped onto the track. A stocky man in a uniform of some variety swaggered around the field and approached the bleachers. Here's trouble, Amos mumbled. It's Mal Brown, Silo said softly. Our illustrious sheriff, Paul said to Neely. Number 31? That's him. Neely's number 19 was the last jersey to be retired. Number 31 was the first. Mal Brown had played in the mid-60s during the streak. 80 pounds and 35 years ago, he had been a bruising tailback who once carried the ball 54 times in a game, still a Messina record. A quick marriage ended the college career before it began, and a quick divorce sent him to Vietnam in time for the Tet Offensive in 68. Neely had heard stories of the great Mal Brown throughout most of his childhood. Before a game Neely's freshman year, Coach Rake stopped by for a quick pep talk. He recounted in great detail how Mal Brown had once rushed for 200 yards in the second half of a conference championship and did so with a broken ankle. Rake loved stories of players who refused to leave the field with broken bones and bleeding flesh and all sorts of gruesome injuries. Years later, Neely would hear that Mal's broken ankle had, more than likely, been a severe sprain. But as the years passed, the legend grew, at least in Rake's memory. The sheriff walked along in front of the bleachers and spoke to the others passing the time. Then he climbed 30 rows and arrived, almost gasping, at Neely's group. He spoke to Paul, then Amos, Silo, Orly, Hubcap, Randy. He knew them all by their first names or nicknames. "Heard you were in town," he said to Neely as they shook hands. Been a long time. It has, was all Neely could say. To his recollection, he had never met Mal Brown. He wasn't the sheriff when Neely lived in Messina. Neely knew the legend, but not the man. Didn't matter. They were fraternity brothers. It's dark, Silo. How come you ain't stealing cars? Mal said. Too early. I'm gonna bust your ass, you know that? I got lawyers. Give me a beer. I'm off duty. Silo handed over a beer and Mal slugged it down. Just left Rakes, he said, smacking his lips as if he hadn't seen liquids in days. Nothing's changed. Just waiting for him to go. The update was received without comment. Where you been hiding? Mal asked Neely. Nowhere. Don't lie. Nobody's seen you around here in 10 years, maybe longer. My parents retired to Florida. I had no reason to come back. This is where you grew up. It's home. Ain't that a reason? Maybe for you. Maybe my ass. You got a lot of friends around here. Ain't right to run away. Drink another beer, Mal, Paul said. Silo quickly passed down another one. Mal grabbed it. After a minute, he said, You got kids?
No.
How's your knee?
It's ruined.
Sorry. A long drink? What a cheap shot. You were clearly out of bounds. I should have stayed in the pocket, Neely said, shifting his weight, wishing he could change the subject. How long would the town of Messina talk about the cheap shot that ruined his career? Another long drink, then Mal said softly, Man, you were the greatest. Let's talk about something else, Neely said. He'd been there for almost 3 hours and was suddenly anxious to leave, though he had no idea where he might be going. 2 hours earlier there had been talk of Mona Curry cooking dinner, but that offer had not been pursued.
Okay.
What? Let's talk about Rake, Neely said. What was his worst team? All bottles rose at once as the group contemplated this. Mal spoke first. He lost 4 games in 76. Miss Lila swears he went into solitary confinement for the winter. Stopped going to mass. Refused to be seen in public. He put the team on a brutal conditioning program. Ran them like dogs all summer. Made them practice 3 times a day in August. When they kicked off in 77, it was a different team. Almost won state. How could Rake lose 4 games in 1 season? Neely asked. Mal leaned back and rested on the row behind him. Took a swig. He was by far the oldest Spartan present, and since he hadn't missed a game in 30 years, he had the floor. Well, first of all, he said, the team had absolutely no talent. The price of timber shot up in the summer of 76, and all the loggers quit. You know how they are. Then the quarterback broke his arm, and there was no backup. We played Harrisburg that year and never threw a pass. Makes it tough when they're sending all 11 on every play. It was a disaster. Harrisburg beat us? Neely asked in disbelief. Yep, the only time in the past 41 years. And let me tell you what those dumb sumbitches did. They're leading late in the game, big score, something like 36-0. Worst night in the history of Messina football. So they figure they've turned the corner in their sad little rivalry with us. They decide to run up the score. With a couple of minutes to go, they throw a reverse pass on 3rd and short. Another touchdown. They're really excited, you know. They're sticking it to the Messina Spartans. Ray kept his cool, wrote it down somewhere in blood, and went looking for loggers. Next year we're playing Harrisburg here. Huge crowd. Angry crowd. We score 7 touchdowns in the first half. I remember that game, Paul said. I was in the first grade. 48-0. 47, Mal said proudly. We scored 4 times in the 3rd quarter, and Rake kept passing. He couldn't sub because he had no bench, but he kept the ball in the air. The final score? Neely asked. 94-0. Still a Messina record. The only time I've ever known Eddie Rake to run up a score. The other group on the north end erupted in laughter as someone finished a story. No doubt about Rake or some long-ago game. Silo had become very quiet in the presence of the law. And when the moment was right, he said, Well, I need to be going. Call me, Curry, if you hear something about Rake. I will. See y'all tomorrow, Silo said, standing, stretching, reaching for 1 last bottle. I need a ride, Hubcap said. It's that time of the night, huh, Silo? Mal said. Time for all good thieves to ease out of the gutter. I'm laying off for a few days, Silo said, in honor of Coach Rake. How touching. I'll just send the night shift boys home then, since you're closing shop. You do that, Mal. Silo, Hubcap, and Amos Kelso lumbered down the bleachers, the metal steps rattling as they descended. He'll be in prison within 12 months, Mal said as they watched him walk along the track behind the end zone. Make sure your bank is clean, Curry. Don't worry. Neil had heard enough. He stood and said, I'll be running along, too. I thought you were coming to dinner, Paul said. I'm not hungry now. How about tomorrow night? Mona'll be disappointed. Tell her to save the leftovers. Good night, Mal, Randy. I'm sure I'll see you soon. The knee was stiff, and as Neely crept down the steps, he tried mightily to do so without a limp, without a hint that he was anything less than what they remembered. On the track, behind the Spartan bench, he turned too quickly, and the knee almost collapsed. It buckled, then wavered, as tiny sharp pains hit in a dozen different spots. Because it happened so often, he knew how to lift it just so and quickly shift all weight to his right leg and keep walking, as if everything was normal. Wednesday. In the window of every shop and store around the Messina Square, there was a large green football schedule, as if the customers and the townsfolk needed help in remembering that the Spartans played every Friday night. And on every lamppost in front of the shops and stores, there were green and white banners that went up in late August and came down when the season was over. Neely remembered the banners from the days when he rode his bike along the walkways. Nothing had changed. The large green schedules were the same every year, the games in bold print, outlined by the smiling faces of the seniors, along the bottom, small ads of all the local sponsors, which included every single business in Messina. No one was left off the schedule. As he entered Renfro's cafe, one step behind Paul, Neely took a deep breath and told himself to smile, to be polite. These folks, after all, once adored him. The thick smell of things frying hit him at the door, then the sound of pots rattling in the distance. The smells and sounds had not changed from the time his father brought him to Renfro's for hot chocolate on Saturday mornings, where the locals relived and replayed the latest Spartan victory. During the season, each football player could eat once a week at Renfro's at no charge, a simple and generous gesture that had been sorely tested shortly after the school was integrated. Would Renfro's allow black players the same privilege? Damn right, came the word from Eddie Rake, and the cafe became one of the first in the state to voluntarily integrate itself. Paul spoke to most of the men huddled over their coffee, but he kept moving toward a booth by the window. Neely nodded and tried to avoid eye contact. By the time they slid into their seats, the secret was out. Neely Crenshaw was back in town. The walls were covered with old football schedules, framed newspaper stories, pennants, autographed jerseys, and hundreds of photos. Team photos lined in neat chronological order above the counter, action shots lifted from the local paper, and large black and whites of the greatest of Spartans. Neely's was above the cash register, a photo of him as a senior, posing with the football cocked and ready to fire. No helmet, no smile, all business and attitude and ego, long, untamed hair, 3 days worth of stubble and peach fuzz, eyes looking somewhere in the distance, no doubt dreaming of future glory. You were so cute back then, Paul said. Seems like yesterday, then it seems like a dream. In the center of the longest wall, there was a shrine to Eddie Rake, a large color photo of him standing near one of the goalposts, and under it the record, 418 wins, 62 losses, 13 state titles. According to the pre-dawn gossip, Rake was still clinging to life, and the town was still clinging to him. The chatter was subdued, no laughter, no jokes, no windy stories of fishing triumphs, none of the usual spats over politics. A tiny waitress in a green and white outfit brought them coffee and took their orders. She knew Paul, but did not recognize the guy with him. Is Maggie still around? Neely asked. Nursing home, Paul said. Maggie Renfro had been serving scalded coffee and oily eggs for decades. She had also dealt relentlessly in all areas of gossip and rumor surrounding the Spartan football team. Because she had given free meals to the players, she had managed to do what everyone else in Messina tried to do. Wiggle in a little closer to the boys and their coach. A gentleman approached and nodded awkwardly at Neely. "Just wanted to say hello," he said, easing out his right hand. "Good to see you again, after all this time. You were something." Neely shook his hand and said, "Thanks." The handshake was brief. Neely broke eye contact. The gentleman took the hint and withdrew. No one followed him. There were quick glances and awkward stares, but the other seemed content to brood over the coffee and ignore him. After all, he had ignored them for the past 15 years. Messina owned its heroes, and they were expected to enjoy the nostalgia. "When was the last time you saw Screamer?" Paul asked. Neely snorted and looked out the window. "I haven't seen her since college." "Not a word?" "One letter, years back. Fancy stationery from some place in Hollywood. Said she was taking the place by storm. Said she'd be a lot more famous than I ever thought about being. Pretty nasty stuff. I didn't respond." "She showed up for our 10-year reunion," Paul said. "An actress. Nothing but blonde hair and legs. Outfits that have never been seen around here. A pretty elaborate production. Name dropping right and left. This producer, that director. A bunch of actors I'd never heard of. I got the impression she was spending more time in bed than in front of the camera." "That's Screamer. You should know. How'd she look?" "Tired." "Any credits?" "Quite a few, and they changed by the hour. We compared notes later, and no one had seen anything she said she'd been in. It was all a show. Typical Screamer. Except that now she's Tessa. Tessa Canyon." "Tessa Canyon," Neely said. "Yep. Sounds like a porn star. I think that's where she's headed." "Poor girl." "Poor girl," Paul repeated. "She's a miserable, self-absorbed idiot whose only claim to fame was that she was Neely Crenshaw's girlfriend." "Yeah, but those legs." They both smiled for a long time. The waitress brought their pancakes and sausage and refilled their coffees. As Paul drenched his plate with maple syrup, he began talking again. 2 years ago, we had a big banker's convention in Vegas. Mona was with me. She got bored, went to the room. I got bored, so I walked along the strip, late at night. I ducked into one of the older casinos, and guess who I saw? Tessa Canyon. Tessa was shuffling booze, a cocktail waitress in one of those tight little costumes that's low in the front and high in the rear. Bleached hair, thick makeup, 20 or so extra pounds. She didn't see me, so I watched her for a few minutes. She looked older than 30. The odd thing was how she performed. When she got near her customers at the tables, a smile came on with a purring little voice that says, "Take me upstairs." The glib one-liners, the bumping and rubbing. Shameless flirting with a bunch of old drunks. The woman just wants to be loved. I tried my best. She's a sad case. That's why I dumped her. She won't come back for the funeral, will she? Maybe. If there's a chance she'll bump into you, then yes, she'll be here. On the other hand, she ain't looking too good, and with Screamer looks are everything. Her parents are still here? Yeah. A chubby man wearing a John Deere cap eased to their table as if he was trespassing. "Just want to say hello, Neely," he said, almost ready to bow. "Name's Tim Nunley, down at the Ford place," he said, offering a hand as if he might be ignored. Neely shook it and smiled. "Used to work on your daddy's cars." "I remember you," Neely lied, but the lie was worth the effort. Mr. Nunley's smile doubled in size, and he squeezed Neely's hand harder. "I thought you would," Mr. Nunley said, glancing at his table for vindication. "Good to see you back here, Neely. You were the greatest." "Thank you," Neely said, releasing his hand and grabbing a fork. Mr. Nunley backed away, waiting to bow, then took his coat and left the restaurant. The conversations were still muted around the tables, as if the wake had already begun. Paul finished a mouthful and leaned in low. 4 years ago we had a good team, he said. Won the first 9 games, undefeated. I was sitting right here, eating the same thing I'm eating now, on a Friday morning, game day, and I swear this is true, the topic of conversation that morning was the streak. Not the old streak, but a new one. These people were ready for a new streak. Never mind a winning season, or a conference title, or even a state championship. They're all peanuts. This town wants 80, 90, maybe 100 wins in a row. Neely looked around quickly, then returned to his breakfast. I've never understood it, he said. These are nice folks. Mechanics, truck drivers, insurance salesmen. Builders, maybe a lawyer, maybe a banker. Solid small-town citizens, but not exactly earth-shakers. I mean, nobody here is making $1 million. But they're entitled to a state championship every year, right? Right. I don't get it. Bragging rights, Neely. What else can they brag about? No wonder they worship Brake. He put the town on the map. Take a bite, Paul said. A man with a dirty apron approached, holding a manila file. He introduced himself as Maggie Renfro's brother, now the chef, and he opened the file. Inside was an 8x10 color photo of Neely at Tech. Maggie always wanted you to sign this, he said. It was a splendid picture of Neely in action, crouching behind the center, calling a play, ready for the snap, sizing up the defense. A purple helmet was visible in the right lower corner, and Neely realized the opponent was A&M. The photo, one he had never seen before, was taken minutes before he was injured. Sure, he said, taking a black marker from the chef. He signed his name across the top, and for a long moment looked into the eyes of a young, fearless quarterback, a star biding his time in college while the NFL waited. He could hear the Tech crowd that day, 75,000 strong and desperate for victory, proud of the undefeated team, thrilled that they, for the first time in many years, had a bona fide All-American at quarterback. Suddenly he longed for those days. Nice photo, he managed to say, handing it back to the chef, who took it and immediately hung it on a nail under the larger photo of Neely. Let's get out of here, Neely said, wiping his mouth. He placed some cash on the table and they began a quick exit. He nodded, smiled politely at the regulars, and managed to make an escape without being stopped. Why are you so nervous around those folks? Paul asked when they were outside. I don't want to talk about football, okay? I don't want to hear how great I was. They drove the quiet streets around the square, passing the church where Neely was baptized and the church where Paul was married, and the handsome split level on 10th Street, where Neely lived from the age of 8 until he left for Tech. His parents had sold it to a certified Yankee who'd been brought down to manage the paper mill west of town. They passed Rake's house, slowly, as if they might hear the latest just by driving down the street. The driveway was crowded with cars, most with out-of-state license plates. Rake's family and close friends, they figured. They passed the park where they played Little League Baseball and Pop Warner football. And they remembered stories. One that was now a legend in Messina was, of course, about Rake. Neely, Paul, and a handful of their buddies were playing a rowdy game of sandlot football when they noticed a man standing in the distance, near the backstop of the baseball field, watching them closely. When they finished, he ventured over and introduced himself as Coach Eddie Rake. The boys were speechless. "You have a nice arm, son," he said to Neely, who could say nothing in response. "I like your feet, too." All the boys looked at Neely's feet. "Is your mother as tall as your father?" Coach Rake asked. "Almost," Neely managed to say. "Good. You'll make a great Spartan quarterback." Rake smiled at the boys and walked away. Neely was 11 years old at the time. They stopped at the cemetery. The approach of the 1992 season caused great concern in Messina. The year before, the team had lost 3 games, a civic disaster that had them grumbling over their biscuits at Renfro's and rubber chicken at the Rotary lunches and cheap beer at the Tonks out in the county. And there had been few seniors on that team, always a bad sign. It was a relief when weak players graduated. If Rake felt pressure, he certainly didn't show it. By then he'd been coaching the Spartans for more than 3 decades and had seen everything. His last state title, number 13, had been in 1987, so the locals were suffering through a 3-year drought. They'd been through worse. They were spoiled and wanted 100 wins in a row, and Rake, after 34 years, didn't care what they wanted. The 92 team had little talent, and everyone knew it. The only star was Randy Yeager, who played corner in wideout, where he caught everything the quarterback could throw near him, which was not very much. In a town the size of Messina, the talent came in cycles. On the upswing, as in 1987, with Neely, Silo, Paul, Alonzo Taylor, and 4 vicious loggers on defense, the scores were lopsided. Rake's greatness, however, was winning with players who were small and slow. He took thin talent and still delivered scores that were lopsided. He worked the lean ones harder, though, and few teams had seen the intensity that Rake brought to the field in August of 1992. After a bad scrimmage on a Saturday afternoon, Rake lashed out at the team and called a Sunday morning practice. Something he rarely did because, in years past, it had upset the church folks. 8 o'clock Sunday morning, so that the boys would have time to attend worship if they were able. Rake was particularly upset over what he perceived to be a lack of conditioning, a joke since every Messina team ran sprints by the hundreds. Shorts, shoulder pads, gym shoes, helmets, no contact, just conditioning. It was 89 degrees by 8 o'clock, with thick humidity and a cloudless sky. They stretched and ran a mile around the track just for a warm-up. Every player was soaked with sweat when Rake called for the second mile. Number 2 on the list of dreaded tortures, just behind the Spartan Marathon, was the assault on the bleachers. Every player knew what it meant, and when Rake yelled, "Bleachers," half the team wanted to quit. Following Randy Yeager, their captain, the players formed a long, reluctant single line and began a slow jog around the track. When the line approached the visitor stands, Yeager turned through a gate and started up the bleachers, 20 rows, then along the top rail, then down 20 rows to the next section. 8 sections on the other side, then back on the track, around the end zone to the home side, 50 rows up, along the top rail, 50 rows down, up and down, up and down, up and down, for another 8 sections, then back on the track for another loop. After one grueling round, the linemen were drifting to the rear, and Yeager, who could run forever, was far in front. Rake growled along the track, whistle hanging around his neck, yelling at the stragglers. He loved the sound of 50 players stomping up and down the bleachers. "You guys are not in shape," he said, just loud enough to be heard. "Slowest bunch I've ever seen." He grumbled again, barely audible. Rake was famous for his grumbling, which could always be heard. After the second round, a tackle fell to the grass and began vomiting. The heavier players were moving slower and slower. Scotty Reardon was a sophomore special teams player who weighed in that August at 141 pounds, but, at the time of his autopsy, weighed 129. During the third round of bleachers, he collapsed between the 3rd and 4th rows on the home side and never regained consciousness. Since it was Sunday morning and a no-contact session, both team trainers were absent at Rake's instructions, nor was there an ambulance close by. The boys would describe later how Rake held Scotty's head in his lap while they waited for an eternity to hear a siren. But he was dead in the bleachers, and he was certainly dead when he finally arrived at the hospital. Heat stroke. Paul was telling the story as they walked through the winding, shaded lanes of the Messina Cemetery. In a newer section, on the side of a steep hill, the headstones were smaller, the rows neater. He nodded at one, and Neely knelt down for a look. Randall Scott Reardon, born June 20, 1977, died August 21, 1992. "And they're going to bury him over there?" Neely asked, pointing to a bare spot next to Scotty. "That's the rumor," Paul said. "This place is always good for a rumor." They walked a few steps to a wrought iron bench under a small elm tree, set, and looked at Scotty's headstone. "Who had the guts to fire him?" Neely asked. The wrong kid died, Paul said. Scotty's family had some money, from timber. His uncle John Reardon was elected superintendent of education in 89. Very highly regarded, smart as hell, smooth politician, and the only person with the authority to fire Eddie Rake. Fire him he did. The town, as you might guess, was shocked by the news of the death, and as the details came out, there was grumbling about Rake and his methods. Lucky didn't kill all of us, Neely said. An autopsy was done on Monday, a clear case of heat stroke. No pre-existing conditions, no defects anywhere. A perfectly healthy 15-year-old leaves home at 7:30 on a Sunday morning for a 2-hour torture session, and he doesn't come home. For the first time in the history of this town, people were asking, why exactly do you run kids in a sauna until they puke? And the answer was, Rake had no answers. Rake said nothing. Rake stayed at home and tried to ride out the storm. A lot of people, including many of those who played for him, thought, well, Rake's finally killed a boy. But a lot of the diehards were saying, hell, that kid wasn't tough enough to be a Spartan. The town split. It got ugly. I like this Reardon fella, Neely said. He's tough. Late Monday night he called Rake and fired him. Everything blew up Tuesday. Rake, typically, couldn't stand the thought of losing in any way, so he worked the phones, stirred up the boosters. No remorse? Who knows how he felt? The funeral was a nightmare, as you might guess. All those kids bawling, some fainting, the players wearing green game jerseys, the band playing right along here at the graveside ceremony. Everybody was watching Rake, who looked quite pitiful. Rake was a great actor. Yeah, and everybody knew it. He'd been fired less than 24 hours earlier, so the funeral had the added drama of his departure. Quite a show, and nobody missed it. Wish I'd been here. Where were you? Summer of 92, out west somewhere, probably Vancouver. The boosters tried to convene a massive meeting on Wednesday in the school gym. Reardon said, not on this campus. So they went to the VFW and had an Eddie Rake revival. Some of the hotheads threatened to cut off the money, boycott the games, picket Reardon's office, even start a new school where I guess they would worship Rake. Was Rake there? Oh, no, he sent Rabbit. He was content to stay at home and work the phones. He truly believed that he could exert enough pressure to get his job back. But Reardon wasn't budging. He went to the assistants and named Snake Thomas as the new head coach. Snake declined. Reardon fired him. Donnie Malone said no. Reardon fired him. Quick Upchurch said no. Reardon fired him. I like this guy more and more. Finally, the Griffin brothers said they would fill in until someone was found. They played for Rake in the late 70s. I remember them. The Pecan Orchard. That's them. Great players. Nice guys. And because Rake never changed anything, they knew the system, the plays, and most of the kids. Friday night rolled around, first game of the season. We were playing Porterville, and the boycott was on. Problem was, nobody wanted to miss the game. Rake's folks, which were probably in the majority, couldn't stay away because they wanted the team to get slaughtered. The real fans were there for the right reasons. The place was packed, as always, with complicated loyalties yelling in all directions. The players were pumped. They dedicated the game to Scotty and won by 4 touchdowns. A wonderful night. Sad because of Scotty and sad because the Rake era was apparently over, but winning is everything. This bench is hard, Neely said, standing. Let's take a walk. Meanwhile, Rake hired a lawyer. A suit was filed, things got ugly. Reardon held his ground, and the town, though deeply divided, still managed to come together every Friday night. The team played with more guts than I've ever seen. Years later, one kid I know said it was such a relief playing football for the sheer fun of it, and not playing out of fear. How beautiful is that? We never knew. No, we didn't. They won the first 8 games, undefeated, nothing but pride and guts. There was talk of a state title. There was talk of a new streak. There was talk of paying the Griffins a bunch of money to start a new dynasty, all that crap. Then they lost. Of course, it's football. A bunch of kids start thinking they're good, and they get their butts kicked. Who did it? Hermantown. No, not Hermantown. It's a basketball school. Did it right here, in front of 10,000 people. Worst game I ever saw. No pride, no guts. Just show them the next press clipping. Forget a streak. Forget a state title. Fire the Griffins. Bring back Eddie Rake. Things were sort of okay when we were winning, but that one loss ripped this town apart for years. And when we lost the next week, we failed to qualify for the playoffs. The Griffins quit immediately. Smart guys. Those of us who played for Rake were caught in the middle. Everyone asked, which side are you on? No fence straddling, bud. You had to declare if you were for Rake or against him. And you? Neely asked. I straddled the fence and got kicked on both sides. It turned into class warfare. There'd always been a small group of people who were opposed to spending more money on football than on science and math combined. We traveled by chartered bus, while every academic club carpooled with their parents. For years, the girls had no softball field, while we had not one but two practice fields. The Latin club qualified for a trip to New York but couldn't afford it. The same year, the football team took the train to watch the Super Bowl in New Orleans. The list is endless. Rake's firing made these complaints louder. The folks who wanted to de-emphasize sports saw their opportunity. The football bubbas resisted. They just wanted Rake and another streak. Those of us who played, then went to college and were considered somewhat enlightened, got caught in the middle. What happened? It smoldered and festered for months. John Reardon stood firm. He found some lost soul from Oklahoma who wanted to coach and hired him as the successor to Eddie Rake. Unfortunately, 93 was re-election year for Reardon, so the whole mess turned into one huge political brawl. There was a strong rumor that Rake himself would run against Reardon. If he got elected, he would anoint himself coach again and tell the whole world to go to hell. There was a rumor that Scotty's father would spend $1 million to re-elect John Reardon, and so on. The race got ugly before it started, so ugly that the Rake camp almost couldn't find a candidate. Who ran? Guy named Dudley Bumpus. The name sounds promising. The name was the best part. He's a local real estate swinger who'd been a big mouth in the boosters. No political experience, no educational experience, barely finished college. Only one indictment, no conviction. A loser who almost won. Reardon held on. Yeah, by 60 votes. The turnout was the largest in the county's history, almost 90%. It was a war with no prisoners. When the winner was announced, Rake went home, locked the door, and hid for 2 years. They stopped at a row of headstones. Paul walked along them, looking for someone. Here, he said, pointing. David Lee Goff, the first Spartan to die in Vietnam. Neely looked at the headstone. There was an inlaid photograph of David Lee, looking all of 16 years old, posing not in an army uniform or a senior portrait, but in his green Spartan jersey, number 22. Born in 1950, killed in 1968. I know his youngest brother, Paul was saying. David Lee graduated in May, entered boot camp in June, arrived in Vietnam in October, died the day after Thanksgiving. 18 years and 2 months old. 2 years before we were born, something like that. There was another one who hasn't been found yet, a black kid, Marvin Rudd, who went missing in action in 1970. I remember Rake talking about Rudd, Neely said. Rake loved the kid. His parents still come to every game, and you wonder what they're thinking. I'm tired of death, Neely said. Let's go. Neely couldn't remember a bookshop in Messina, nor a place to get an espresso or buy coffee beans from Kenya. Nat's place now provided all three, along with magazines, cigars, CDs, off-color greeting cards, herbal teas of dubious origin, vegetarian sandwiches and soups, and a meeting place for drifting poets and folk singers and the few wannabe bohemians in the town. It was on the square, four doors down from Paul's bank, and a building that sold feed and fertilizer when Neely was a kid. Paul had some loans to make, so Neely explored by himself. Nat Sawyer was the worst punter in the history of Spartan football. His average yards per kick had set record lows, and he fumbled so many snaps that Rake would normally just go for it on 4th and 8, regardless of where the ball was. With Neely at quarterback, a good punter was not a necessity. Twice during their senior year, Nat had somehow managed to miss the ball with his foot entirely, creating some of the most watched video footage in the program's history. The second miss, which was actually two misses on the same punt, resulted in a comical 94-yard touchdown run, which lasted, according to an accurate timing of the video, 17.3 seconds. Standing in his own end zone, and quite nervous about it, Ned had taken the snap, released the ball, kicked nothing but air, then been slaughtered by two defenders from Grove City. As the ball was spinning benignly on the ground nearby, Ned collected himself, picked it up, and began to run. The two defenders, who appeared to be stunned, gave a confused chase, and Ned tried an awkward punt on the fly. When he missed, he picked the ball up again, and the race was on. The sight of such an ungainly gazelle lumbering down the field, in sheer terror, froze many of the players from both teams. Silo Mooney later testified that he was laughing so hard he couldn't block for his punter. He swore he heard laughter coming from under the helmets of the Grove City players. From the video, the coaches counted 10 missed tackles. When Nat finally reached the end zone, he spiked the ball, didn't care about the penalty, ripped off his helmet, and rushed to the home side so the fans could admire him at close range. Rake gave him an award for the ugliest touchdown of the year. In the 10th grade, Ned had tried playing safety, but he couldn't run and hated to hit. In the 11th, he had tried receiver, but Neely nailed him in the gut on a slant, and Ned couldn't breathe for 5 minutes. Few of Rake's players had been cursed with so little talent. None of Rake's players looked worse in a uniform. The window was filled with books and advertised coffee and lunch. The door squeaked, a bell rattled, and for a moment Neely was stepping back in time. Then he got the first whiff of incense, and he knew Nat ran the place. The owner himself, hauling a stack of books, stepped from between two saggy shelves, and with a smile said, "Good morning. Looking for something?" Then he froze, and the books fell to the floor. "Neely Crenshaw." He lunged with as much awkwardness as he'd used punting a football, and the two embraced, a clumsy hug in which Neely caught a sharp elbow on his bicep. "It's great to see you," Nat gushed, and for a second his eyes were wet. "It's good to see you too, Nat," Neely said, slightly embarrassed. Fortunately, at that moment, there was only one other customer. "You're looking at my earrings, aren't you?" Nat said, taking a step back. "Well, yes, you have quite a collection." Each ear was loaded with at least 5 silver rings. "First male earrings in Messina. How about that? And the first ponytail. And the first openly gay downtown merchant. Aren't you proud of me?" Nat was flipping his long black hair to show off his ponytail. "Sure, Nat, you're looking good." Nat was sizing him up from head to toe, his eyes flashing as if he'd been guzzling espresso for hours. "How's your knee?" he asked, glancing around as if the injury was a secret. "Gone for good, Nat. Son of a bitch hit you late. I saw it." Ned had the authority of someone standing on the sideline that day at Tech. "A long time ago, Nat, in another life. How about some coffee? I got some stuff from Guatemala that gives one a hell of a buzz." They wove through the shelves and racks to the rear, where an impromptu cafe materialized. Ned walked, almost ran, behind a cluttered counter and began slinging utensils. Neely straddled a stool and watched. Nothing Ned did was graceful. "They say he's got less than 24 hours, Nat said, rinsing a pot. "Rumors are always reliable around here, Nat, especially about Rake." "No, this came from someone inside the house." The challenge in Messina was not to have the latest rumor, but to have the best source. "Want a cigar? I got some smuggled Cubans, another great buzz." "No thanks, Nat, I don't smoke." Nat was pouring water in a large Italian-made machine. "What kind of work you doing?" he asked over his shoulder. "Real estate. Man, that's original. Pays the bills. Pretty cool store you have here, Nat. Curry tells me you're doing well." "I'm just trying to breathe some culture into this desert. Paul loaned me $30,000 to get started. Can you believe that? I had nothing but an idea, and $800, and of course my mother was willing to sign the note." "How's she doing?" "Great, thanks. She refuses to age. Still teaching the 3rd grade. When the coffee was brewing properly, Nat leaned next to the small sink and stroked his bushy mustache. "Rake's gonna die, Neely. Can you believe that? Messina without Eddie Rake. He started coaching here 44 years ago. Half the people in this county weren't born then. Have you seen him? He was in here a lot, Nat said, but when he got sick, he went home to die. Nobody's seen Rake in 6 months. Neely glanced around. Rake was here? Rake was my first customer. He encouraged me to open this place. Gave me the standard pep talk. Have no fear. Work harder than the other guy. Never say die. The usual halftime rah-rah. When I opened, he liked to sneak down here in the mornings for coffee. Guess he figured he was safe because there wasn't exactly a crowd. Most of the yokels thought they'd catch AIDS when they walked in the front door. When did you open? 7.5 years ago. Couldn't pay the light bill for the first 2 years. Then it slowly came around. Rumor spread that this was Rake's favorite place, so the town got curious. I think the coffee's ready, Neely said as the machine hissed. I never saw Rake read a book. Nat poured 2 small cups on saucers and placed them on the counter. Smells potent, Neely said. It ought to require a prescription. Rake asked me one day what he might like to read. I gave him a Raymond Chandler. He came back the next day and asked for another. He loved the stuff. Then I gave him Dashiell Hammett. Then he went nuts over Elmore Leonard. I opened at 8, one of the very few bookstores to do so, and once or twice a week Rake would come in early. We'd sit in the corner over there and talk about books. Never football or politics. Never gossip. Just books. He loved the detective stories. When we heard the bell ring on the front door, he would sneak out the back and go home. Why? Nat took a long sip of coffee, with a small cup disappearing into the depths of his unruly mustache. We didn't talk about it much. Rake was embarrassed because he got sacked like that. He has enormous pride,